history through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are stories there that we're better off hearing. We don't want them to go untold, and we want to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice. We want to preserve their stories so we never forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And along the way, we sure do learn a lot. We're educated, we're entertained, and so often inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. I know that's going to be the case today in beautiful San Luis Obispo, California, with 96-year-old Lou Goodman. And if you're ever around the San Luis Obispo Airport on a Saturday morning, you've got to stop into the Spirit of San Luis restaurant. You can see the planes on the tarmac, the beautiful scenery, and you're going to hear Lou Goodman holding court with people a lot younger than he is, treating them to breakfast and telling a few stories. We're going to be blessed to hear those stories today on Hometown Heroes. We're going to hear about his time in the 91st Bomb Group flying out of England, some very hairy moments that he survived. But Lou, I want to take you back way before that. You're 96, so when you were growing up in Southern California in the 1920s and 30s, what do you remember about those days? What was life like with your two brothers and your sister there?
We were very, very poor. My mother cleaned houses and offices. You brought it up. I'm going to tell you this.
All right.
On Saturday, she'd count the money she made for the week. She had four envelopes there. First one was tithes. Second one was rent. Third one was utilities. The fourth one was food. And she'd fill them in that order. And one day, my older sister said, "Mother, you're going to run out of money. We're not going to have enough money for food." And my mother said, "You could never outgive God." So that's the way we lived. First people she paid was her tithe money.
That stuck with you.
Yes.
So, I mean, these are the years of the Great Depression.
Yep.
And it sounds like that was something that was very palpable for you. You could feel the Great Depression.
Let me tell you this. You see this ring?
Uh-huh.
I enlisted in the military at 18.
Uh-huh.
And they sent me to the cavalry. And my mother would call me every week. And she said, "I thought when you went in the military, you were going to apply for the cadets." And I said, "Mom, I thought about it, but I said, you got to have 2 years junior college to apply to be in the cadets." And she said, how do you change it? And she said, "I'd have to have a couple of businessmen write me letters." So next week, I get two letters, one from a doctor, one from a lawyer, recommending that I be considered for the cadet program. So I was in Anniston, Alabama. I went to Birmingham to take the test. I told my mother, "Mother, it's a waste. I can't pass that test. You ready for this?"
Uh-huh.
"Brace yourself." She said, "Yes, you can." She said, "I'm going to be praying for you and the Lord's with you." And I went and took that test and passed it and became a cadet.
How about that?
When I graduated and got my commission, my mother bought this ring for me. Cost her $90. My son checked and he said the minimum wage in that year was 30 cents an hour. And she bought this ring for me.
I can tell you had a special relationship with your mother.
Oh, yeah, we did. My mother was a prayer warrior. She loved me so much. She had four kids. I was her favorite.
What would the other ones tell me?
I don't know. I don't know.
And,
you know.
Well, among those four in the birth order, which one were you?
I was number three.
Uh-huh.
I was number three.
So kids today have video games and smartphones and all this technology. When you were a kid, what kind of tricks were you up to? How did you pass your time?
We played kick the can out in the alley.
Mm-hmm.
And hide and seek, you know. We were outside doing something outside. But kick the can and hide and seek was one of the first couple of favorites.
And what part of Southern California were you in?
Los Angeles. We lived in an apartment at Olympic and Union.
Uh-huh. What about when you're a kid and you think about what you're going to do when you grow up? Did you have some ideas, some hopes and dreams, some ambitions?
I don't remember having. I just know it was desperate to live. I went into the three C's because we were so hard up for money. So it was just a hard time. And I didn't think about the future. The war changed all that for me. The war changed it. And the fact that I went in, and the fact that my mother sent me those two letters, and the fact that I went to Birmingham, Alabama, and the fact that I passed that test, what a difference it made. What a difference it made in my life.
You've thought about that, how different things would have been.
What would have happened if she hadn't sent me those two letters? Mm-hmm. I would have been in the military. I could have been killed serving with Patton. You know, a lot of the guys didn't make it back.
And one of your brothers served under Patton.
He served under Patton. He was a truck driver for him, yeah.
So you had one brother who was doing that. You had another brother in the Merchant Marine.
Right.
But I want to touch on something you just said. You mentioned the three C's. So before America entered World War II, the Civilian Conservation Corps had all these work projects all over the country. Building facilities in some points, clearing roads. So you were what, 16 when you signed up for that?
16, yeah.
And your motivation was, I can help my family's finances.
Right.
So you leave home. You quit school.
Yeah.
After the 10th grade, you're gone?
10th grade.
What was that like for you, to be with all these other teenage boys, and what kind of work were you doing?
Well, the group that I was with were in the hills, and they were making fire paths. Mm-hmm. You know, what, trimming trees away so if the fire came, it couldn't jump over here and this sort of thing. Old stinky me, I got a job in the kitchen. I worked in the kitchen.
A lot of guys that I've interviewed over the years were part of that effort, the CCC. Sending the money back home to help out. And, you know, it sounds like it was a very military-like experience.
Oh, it was, yes. Yeah. We lived in a barracks with a lot of other people, other guys. Oh, me, I got a job in the kitchen. I got the easy route. I wasn't going up those hills and trim those trees. Okay.
Well, let me ask you this, because it seems like everybody who I've talked to who was alive then has a memory of December 7th, 1941.
Yeah.
Do you remember how you found out about what happened at Pearl Harbor?
I was in a car with my brother-in-law, and we had gone to the hospital to visit my aunt, who was in the hospital, and we heard on the radio that Pearl Harbor had been bombed.
How did you receive that news? What kind of reaction did that draw from you?
Well, I was taken by it, and I knew that I was headed for the military. I knew that right away. I'm going into the military.
And you were 17 when that happened.
I was 17.
But before that, you had met someone who would turn out to be pretty important in your life.
My wife.
How did you and Paula Jean meet?
Her aunt was married to my uncle, and she was there from Texas one summer, spending the summer with her aunt, and I met her then. I was 16 years old. Mm-hmm. She was 16 years old. So we got acquainted, and then she went back to Texas. But when I got in the service, she was in Dallas, and I was in Houston. I contacted her, and on weekends when I had off, I think it was about train ride to Dallas, I'd go see her and visit her. Mm-hmm. And during that course of the time, we fell in love and got engaged.
What was it about her that was so special that caught your eye?
She was just a very, very beautiful, special human being in every way. You know, how do you know what really ties you to somebody? But I was taken with her right away. I fell in love with her right away.
You told me the story of the taking the test, and you believe it was your mother's prayers that got you through.
I have no doubt about that. Mm-hmm. I have no doubt about that.
So let's talk about some of those things you did in training.
Okay.
When you got into the Army Air Corps, when you passed that test, where did they send you?
Midland, Texas. We started working on the bomb site, you know, synchronizing targets and things like that from big machine.
Mm-hmm.
So they started training me.
Was that something that came to you naturally, or did you have to kind of work at it?
I felt good doing it. I could handle it, yes.
And was this the Norden bomb site already, or they didn't have
the
that?
The Norden bomb site. Norden bomb site. Yeah, you knew that. Okay.
How did that work? For those of us who've never looked through it, how did you figure out how to do your job?
You looked through the bomb site, and there were crosshairs there.
Mm-hmm.
And you would synchronize on a target. And when you got those crosshairs on that target, you'd release your bombs.
So you're over there training. You're sneaking over to see Paula Jean on the weekend.
Yes.
You know you're going to go overseas.
Yes.
You know that being an airman over Europe is pretty dangerous duty.
Yes.
Did you hesitate at all to to propose to her? Were you concerned that you might not come back?
Well, I don't recall that, and it was kind of an unofficial engagement. But she told me she loved me, and I loved her. So we kind of left it at that.
Uh-huh.
So, and then we communicated by mail during the war and everything. So, no, I knew there was a chance I wouldn't come back. I knew that. But you can't live with that expectation. You got to live your life day by day.
Mm-hmm.
Day by day. And it worked out okay.
Well, what were you thinking about when you headed overseas?
I was probably scared to death. I don't remember. I was probably scared.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Yeah.
You know, and then we went to Lincoln, Nebraska for extreme more training. So, and that's when I got with my first war crew, was there in Lincoln, Nebraska. We trained together.
So, you know, for people who haven't done this before, a B-17 has a crew.
Yeah.
Is that a 10-man crew?
Usually 10, sometimes 9, but usually 10.
So what were your duties going to be? Your responsibilities from the start of a mission to the end of the mission, what would you
be doing?
Mine
was synchronize on the target and drop those bombs, and I got so good at it that my nickname became Magic.
Magic.
I was that close to target all the time, so.
And was there anything that you had to do leading up to the bomb run or after the bomb run?
After a bomb run, we would be interviewed for a long time.
Mm-hmm.
And had a glass of brandy in front of us or something. Before we'd go on a war, on a run, we would have a big interview room for, you know, with all the pilots and navigators who were going to fly that day with instructions and that sort of thing and what kind of target it was. We would be instructed before we left, and when we got back, we'd be interviewed to what happened on the bomb run.
So you said you met your first war crew in Lincoln, Nebraska.
Yeah.
You guys got to practice,
yeah,
fly together. What can you tell me about those guys?
They were a great bunch of guys. Jack Brown, who was the pilot, got out of the war, came back about the time I did. He stayed in the service and went somewhere in Texas as a pilot, teaching other guys how to fly.
Mm-hmm.
He got in an airplane crash and got killed.
Oh, no.
Yeah. He went through the war, through 30 missions, came back and got killed training some guy to fly an airplane. Bad.
Do you remember your first impression of the B-17, the first time you went up in one of those and what that was like?
Yeah, I know it was big. It was big.
Well, and you had the best seat in the house, didn't you?
I'm right in the nose. I'm right in the nose, yeah.
Which means you're the most vulnerable, aren't
you?
Oh,
yeah. Yeah, when we got in foggy territory sometimes and had to come off of a target, man, I was seeing other airplanes flying by me, you know, real quick, real close. I'm right there in the nose, right there.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's the best seat in the house, I guess.
You know, if you're flying in formation and the flak is coming up and pinpointing your altitude, it's going to hit you before anybody else.
There's something in that book about some guy that wrote something,
yeah,
the pilot, about the flak coming into the nose of the airplane. And me and Pete were the two guys there that he's talking about. It's in there somewhere. About all the flak that came into the nose and how we lucked out that they didn't hit us, but it was all through the nose of the airplane.
Yeah, here's what it says. This is a book chronicling the exploits of the 91st Bomb Group. It says, flak busted the plexiglass in the nose and ricocheted 6 times around the nose, just missed the navigator and bombardier. Also, a hole just above the pilot's head. The burst sounded like someone shot off a shotgun in a silent room. Don't the Germans know it's dangerous to have metal flying around in the air that way? So that kind of sounds like it's making light of it a little bit, but this was serious business. What do you remember about that moment in that B-17? Called Margie.
I remember I was scared to death, I think. I don't know. You know, how do you recall? You know, you're asking me stuff 75 years ago. It's hard to remember, Paul, how I felt and so on.
Well, maybe you can help us understand what it was like, because I'm thinking
yeah,
about a B-17.
Okay.
And there could be metal plating beneath the cockpit to,
yes,
protect people.
Yeah.
But all you have separating you
is plexiglass.
Yeah.
Plexiglass in the nose.
That's, yeah, not going to stop anti-aircraft fire,
no,
or
no,
a fighter plane's bullets.
God was watching out for me. That's all I can say.
So if you're sitting in that nose,
yeah,
and you see bursts of flak, those black puffs of smoke,
oh, yeah,
in front of you,
yeah,
what do you do?
You kind of hope for the best. But, you know, in addition to the flak, we also had to contend with enemy aircraft. coming through our shooting at us.
Yeah.
That's why we tried to fly in formation to keep that from as little as possible. But we had enemy aircraft shooting at us, too. They were coming up getting us, as well as the flak. When we got over target, we'd hit flak. Before we got to target and after we got left target, we had enemy aircraft after us.
You flew 30 missions.
Oh, yeah.
How often would you say you encountered the enemy fighters?
Every mission.
Every single mission?
Almost every mission, as I can recall. Not everyone, but quite a few of them. Yeah, we were there.
And you've already heard one example of what that could be like, but you're going to hear more from 96-year-old Lou Goodman when we come back. Head over to hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page for photos and a short video of Lou. And Hometown Heroes will be right back after this.